What's up, my friend? All right, let's get real for a second. Let's get real. Do you know what your online business personality is? Seriously, do you know what your online business personality is? Well, I want to help you figure out what makes you so good at what you do in your business. And also, as you very likely know from listening to the podcast here, I want to help you find your hidden blind spots, the blind spots that are tripping you up and keeping you from gaining the traction and momentum that you want and that you need to grow your online course business. And they're blind spots because we are so close to our business that we don't even know what they are, but we all have them. And I want to help you discover what those are. Because when you discover what the invisible roadblocks are that are preventing you from gaining momentum and traction towards scaling your business or 6 and 7 figures, that's when things really take off. So I put together a super fun quiz for you. It's like 11 questions. It'll take you like 47 seconds to complete this quiz. rickmulready.com/quiz. At the end of that quiz, you are going to get very personalized results that are going to help you take focused forward action with 3 specific steps. Okay, that you can start using right away to create sustainable, consistent revenue and build a business that works for you, even when you're not working, right? rickmulready.com/quiz. Go take it. Let me know what your results are. Let's dive into it. Welcome to the Art of Online Business podcast. My name is Rick Mulready, and I'm an online business coach, Facebook and Instagram ads expert, lifestyle entrepreneur, and I'm a total coffee snob as well. Each week, you're going to learn actionable strategies, mindsets, and tips that take the guesswork out of growing and scaling a profitable online business so that you can truly become an entrepreneur with impact. This podcast is your secret weapon for fast-tracking the growth of your online business. Let's do this. All right. Welcome back to the show, my friend. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Hope this finds you well, you and your family safe. And well, love this time of year in San Diego. Things are starting to get a little cooler, down to like 63. That's like the high of the day today, which I love. And a little cloudy outside, which I love as well. Got some nice foliage out there, like little leaf turning. And I'm geeking out on this stuff because I am from New Hampshire originally. I love the change in seasons, but this is my favorite time of year here in San Diego, the winter time. So good stuff. Anyway, hope you're doing well. Thanks so much for tuning in today and hanging out with me. We're going to talk about legal stuff for your online business. And I say that, no, this is really important. And I geek out about this stuff. I love it. And joining me to share his expertise is a lawyer by the name of Jim Hart. And Jim's actually one of our accelerator members. And Jim helps online entrepreneurs on the legal side. And so I asked him to come on today because it's been a long time since we covered anything legal here on the show. And it can be a very boring topic, right? And nobody wants to talk about it, but it is uber, uber important. And one of Jim's gifts is that he's an approachable guy. You know, the law can feel kind of stuffy sometimes. Well, Jim is very approachable in how he teaches what you need to know in running an online business from a legal side, and super approachable, very understandable. And so that's why I asked him to come on here. And he's going to be talking about the biggest legal mistakes that online entrepreneurs are making. He's going to share what the lock it down system is all about. He's going to share how you should be setting up your business from a legal standpoint, like LLC, sole proprietor, that sort of thing. 2 things that your website absolutely needs to have. He's going to share where online experts should absolutely start when it comes to protecting yourself legally. What kinds of things that you need to do to protect yourself when it comes to testimonials. Thought this was super, super interesting. He gets into copyright versus trademark, which I always get mixed up. What you can do when someone is pirating your course. We talk about all kinds of things, and this is a must listen, my friend. Okay. So even though it's a law stuff, even though it's legal jargon and all that stuff, it's super, super important. And Jim is really, really good at breaking it down for you. So without further ado, let's dive into it with Jim Hart. Jim, this is like you and me sitting down for coffee. Welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
Are you a coffee drinker? I don't think we've ever talked about this.
Oh, I'm definitely a coffee drinker, but not after noon, because that's when, if I do that, then I stay up all night.
I had a half calf yesterday because I'd already had two, and around 3:30, I grabbed my daughter and we ran out to the coffee shop here, and like I'm a little embarrassed to say that I had a half calf, because I process caffeine really quickly, but like I was pretty like awake. I had a hard time going to sleep last night.
Yeah, I had one yesterday afternoon because I did a webinar last night, and that was a huge mistake. I couldn't fall asleep at all last night, and I was awake at like 3:30 in the morning. So.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
But no,
I'm not going to make that mistake again.
Yeah. No later day caffeine for you.
No.
We are not here to talk about coffee, though, although it'd be a fun conversation. We're here to talk about the legal side of running an online business, the side that no one really wants to talk about because it's the scary side, right? But we're going to remove all that fear today. And so, before we do that, why don't you introduce yourself to everybody listening, who you are, what you do, and how you help online entrepreneurs?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Rick, for having me. And my name is Jim Hart. I am a lawyer and an online entrepreneur myself. I have been practicing law for about 15, 16 years now. I'm in North Carolina, and I'm the founder of Hawthorne Law, which is an online business devoted to helping people get their legal house in order. It is kind of a spin-off of my normal law firm, where I do help clients on a one-to-one basis. And I have a YouTube channel with over 100,000 subscribers now, where I talk all things legal on it. And I try to do it in a fun and creative way that gets people excited about making sure their business is protected. I know that's hard to do.
Yeah. So how do you do that, actually? Because that's a great segue into this conversation, because law, you know, can feel kind of stuffy, right? But you bring that light feeling to it and the approachable feeling to it. So how, like, what's the magic in doing that?
Well, I think what is really caught on, and what people tell me they like about my YouTube channel, is the fact that I'm relatable. Like, I don't act like a normal lawyer on the channel. You know, I'm not wearing a suit. I'm not in front of a bunch of law books. I'm not doing any of that kind of stuff. I think one of my most popular videos, I literally hadn't taken a shower that day. My hair was all messed up. I was wearing a t-shirt, and I just put the video together in just a few short minutes. That was at the very beginning. I don't do that. I try not to do that anymore. But I was just having a call with a client today, and she was telling me, she's like, I don't know how I do it, but they say you're very relatable. You're slightly funny, but you get the information out, and you're just someone that, you know, you're like a normal person, as opposed to a stuffy lawyer who's sitting there in front of these books saying, you know, I'm such and such from the such and such law firm, and here is what you need to know about contracts. And I don't do it that way. I try and make it, you know, I usually drink my coffee on the channel, and, you know,
you don't have your law books behind you and your school diplomas and stuff like that up on the wall behind you?
No, I leave those in the conference room, but I don't typically do videos in there. But no.
My question for you on that is, if your one of your most viewed and popular videos was just you in a t-shirt and your hair all whatever, why aren't you doing more of that?
I think it was the subject matter more so than what I look like. Oh, okay. But that was one of my, like, I back then I didn't have, nobody was watching the channel, right? And I probably would, a normal person would take that video down, but when it's got 300,000 or 400,000 views, you let it go. So that's what I've done.
You let that go. Yeah. So I want to get into some of the big legal mistakes that online entrepreneurs make. I think a good place, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a good place to start this conversation is, what should we even be thinking about from a legal perspective? Like, I'm coming up on 7 years in business, and it's not something I really think about a whole lot. I mean, I became an LLC in my business early on, but I didn't really know. I mean, it's just not something that's talked about a whole lot. So where should people at least start?
And I think the reason why it's not talked about, and I'll just say this, and I'll kind of tell you where I think people need to go if they're just starting out. there's not really any such thing as an online business lawyer, right? You've got so many different areas that encapsulate what an online business is. You've got contracts, you've got your LLC, the corporate formation, those type of things. You've got intellectual property issues. You've got FTC issues. You've got employment issues. I mean, there's tax issues. There's so many different things that that encompass what an online business is. A lot of it is national in scope. So, you know, it's not like a normal business that people have where they can go to their employment lawyer and deal with these small little issues, or a family law attorney, or a criminal. I mean, there's just so much. And so, and plus, most lawyers, let's be honest, don't know the first thing about online business and what that means or what any of this stuff is. I learned about 10 years ago that this was something I really was passionate about and really enjoyed doing. It was just trying to figure out a way that I could merge those interests with the law. And finally, I was able to figure out how to do that. At least I think I was. Anyway, that's just as a background. I think that is the big issue, is there's not a lot of lawyers that cater to this space. In terms of the biggest mistakes I see people make, there's a ton of them. But I would say more than anything else, you know, just when I look at a website, the first thing I do is I scroll to the bottom and look to see if they've got a privacy policy and a terms of service. And I've seen really big entrepreneurs who are really successful, who I know are very successful, and they don't have these things on their website. And that is a huge no-no, especially if you're running ads. The privacy laws, you know, you're in California. Mm-hmm. California has some pretty strict privacy laws.
Yep.
There's GDPR that you need to be aware of. And if you're messing this up, I mean, you could get in trouble. Like if somebody gets upset with you, or you rub somebody the wrong way and they report you to the FTC, you could get a letter in the mail that's not going to be a very good letter. Yeah. So there are things that could, that's probably one of the biggest things I see is failure to have those privacy policies in place, or having one that's just not valid now. Because sometimes, you know, you said you've been in business for a while. Mm-hmm. They put their privacy policy in place, you know, 10 years ago. Well, I tell you what, GDPR wasn't in effect 10 years ago. So you need to update these things too. So I'd say that's, in terms of mistakes, those are the biggest mistakes I see.
As you were talking about, I was literally going to my website. I'm like, yep, 99% sure we have that. But with that said, I do need to update it with the new California, because I'm in California, and the new California privacy stuff that just went into effect, well, within the past 60 days or so, I think it was. So how do people ensure that they have the right information on documents like a terms of use and a privacy policy?
Well, I mean, I think that it's always helpful to go to a lawyer and have them draft it for you. And if you don't want to spend the money to do that, because that can be expensive. But honestly, if you're going to a lawyer to have them draft something like that, it's probably within the scope of a larger engagement. You're having them do other things like set up your LLC, like do a trademark, like general counsel type of thing. So when I work with people nationwide, that's how I do it. I do it on a general counsel monthly retainer type of agreement. And all these things are included in that. If you don't want to do that, certainly you don't have to do that. You can go and purchase templates online. I would typically recommend going to a lawyer's website to get a template, because those are usually going to be the most up to date. And I've seen, I'm not going to name any names, but there's some big companies out there that sell these things, and I've looked at them and clients have shown them to me and they're absolute garbage. So I would typically go to a lawyer to purchase these templates. Obviously, we sell these templates both a la carte and as part of a larger course that we offer. So and that's where I would go. I'd be hesitant to go to some of the bigger, you know, more commercial websites, because those aren't always the best templates, but some of them are good.
And that's a good point, because many times people would do that just to save money, because they generally are cheaper to purchase, mm-hmm. right? But if they're not, I don't want to say accurate, but if they're not, you know, up to par, then it's wasted money as it is.
Well, yeah, and that's good. And that's a good, I'm glad you raised that point, because a lot of times people are, you know, what's the phrase? Penny smart, pound foolish, or something like that. They're looking right now, okay, I need this cheap, so I'm going to go buy a privacy policy online for $10, mm-hmm. And not know if it's valid or not. And the only way, unfortunately, you figure that out is if, like I said, you get a letter from the FTC. And by then, it's too late, because you're going to be spending a lot more than $10 to deal with that. I heard a podcast from another attorney recently that was talking about somebody made some mistakes and the FTC came after them and they had like an $8 million fine. Now, mind you, this was an online entrepreneur that was doing quite a bit in terms of revenue, many multiples more than that. Yeah. But that's still a huge fine. I don't think anyone wants to give up that much money just because you messed something up with your website. And I think they were doing more than that too.
You've piqued my interest. What are some of those things that are being, that are attracting the FTC's attention? What's getting them on their radar?
I think anytime you're doing something that's whether intentional or not, but is going to deceive the public, I think that's going to be a problem. So if you make claims that aren't true, I think this person was doing some stuff with, they were teaching how to trade stocks and options and things of that sort. And they were using testimonials that weren't entirely accurate. And I think they were doing things like that. So anytime, especially in the financial space, you get into that and you're trying to get people to rely on things to buy your product that are not necessarily legit, that's going to be a problem. And so you got to be very careful. Use of testimonials. A lot of people mess up the use of testimonials. They don't use the proper disclaimers with the testimonials, or they pay for testimonials, which in my book is just an absolute no-no. And so, and payment doesn't have to be like cash. It could be like, hey, I'm going to give you a free copy of my course. Give me a testimonial. Mm-hmm. But then they don't disclose that they gave a free copy of the course. So there's that's where people can make some mistakes when it comes to those type of things.
What kind of disclaimers do you need if it's just like a general, like, let's just say somebody has taken your course or program or whatever it is, and they get amazing results and they're like, yeah, I want to give you a testimonial. What kind of, number one, do you need to have something written from the perspective of like some sort of document? And I assume who I'm talking to, yes, is going to tell me, yes, we need some sort of document that says that we have permission to use their, you know, to use their testimonial. But in addition to that, well, number one, do we need something like that? Number two, what kind of disclaimer do we need to include for something like that?
I would have some disclaimers right within your terms of service. But in addition to that, you may want to have a testimonial disclaimer in the footer of your website that's on every single page. You could have an earnings disclaimer, especially if you're teaching people how to make money. You probably want to have some sort of earnings disclaimer that says, you know, results aren't typical, you know, results may vary by depending on how much time and effort you put into this. So if you are, if you're teaching in the health and wellness space, you're going to want to have some sort of medical disclaimers. There's all sorts of disclaimers that you want. And I typically, especially if it's the main focus of your website, affiliate disclaimers is another one. You're going to want to have a policy and usually include that in the footer that's separate and apart from your terms of service, although you may want to include it in the terms of service as well. In terms of, like I said, I'm not a big fan of giving people product or cash or anything like that in exchange for a testimonial. I think that's a bad practice and is likely to get you in more trouble than it's worth. If you do something like that, and don't quote me on that, I'd have to check the regs with the FTC. I'm not going to go so far as to say it's illegal, but I think that there just has to be very strongly worded disclaimers and they have to be very prominent that this person was paid for the testimonial. And so you just need to be very careful about that. So, and I would probably, if there's something like that going on, I would probably have the language very close to the testimonial in a very prominent space where somebody can see this was a paid testimonial.
What about something that's come up for me in the past? Nothing like, just things I've thought about because I've heard it from other people. What about, like, for example, you coming on this podcast here? Do I need some form of document that allows me to use this interview on the show?
Theoretically, yes, because we're both sitting here talking. We're both going to be copyright holders to this podcast. Ideally, yes, you would do something like that. Back when I did podcasts, what I would typically do is I would send somebody an email prior to the podcast and kind of list out the rules and of the road, so to speak, and say, you know, please understand that by engaging in the podcast and by participating, you are turning over all copyright in the podcast to me. Mm. So yeah, I would typically do something like that. I think that's smart from a business standpoint.
Sure.
Again, it's one of those things where not a lot of people worry about it and a lot of people don't, but it only takes one person to, you know, make your life a living hell before you realize that's why we have those things.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, the legal aspect, I think, tends to be reactive instead of proactive, mm-hmm. like reactive in a sense of like, yeah, something's coming up. Oh, I need to take care of this, you know, legally now. But yet if we're proactive in these things, like you're saying, we can get in front of these things and it's not, or we're making it less of a problem, hopefully, by doing it proactively.
Oh, yeah. It costs much less to do it, to handle it right now than wait until it goes bad.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely.
What about the whole, you know, when people are early in their business, you know, LLC, sole proprietor, you know, S Corp, all that stuff. S Corp, I know, well, maybe not. It's a little bit more CPA stuff.
Not necessarily. Well, I mean, yes.
Let's talk about that. Because
I'm happy to talk about that.
A lot. Like how does one know how they quote unquote should be setting up their business?
Well, so let's start with the LLC thing. And obviously LLCs are very popular right now. I talk a lot about them on my channel. And my general guidance to people when you're just getting started and you're trying to figure out, should I have an LLC? Should I not have an LLC? This is really important this time of year too, because it's the end of the year, a lot of people are trying to do things to save money on taxes, right? And so people are wondering, should I start my LLC now? Should I wait till January? And what I typically tell people, number one, you don't need an LLC to be in business. You can be a sole proprietor and that's fine. The only reason to start an LLC is if you're trying to protect your personal assets. Like that's what it's for. It's a limited liability company. The whole idea is to protect your assets. So number one, if you don't have assets, then you probably don't need an LLC. So if people are starting out and they've got like $100 in the bank and the clothes on their back, well, they probably don't need an LLC. Once we get past that, then we start to look at some other things and I'll ask people, you know, do you have any revenue from the business? Have you earned any money? Because if you haven't earned any money, you don't have anyone that's going to sue you anyway. So that's the second thing I look at is the business earning any revenue? That's a consideration. And then the last thing I look at is how risky is your business, right? So if you are in a business like I was saying, like you're teaching people, like your friend Jason Brown, teaching people how to mm-hmm. trade stocks and options. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very high risk business, right? I'd be nervous about that business. He was not the one that I was talking about earlier, by the way. Right. But anyway, so you know that's a high risk business. Giving medical or health advice, I think that's a high risk business. I think there's a lot of life coaches out there right now who are getting into that business and, you know, you got to be very careful because you're in a situation where are you a life coach or are you a therapist? Well, a therapist has to be licensed. A life coach doesn't. So you got to be very careful about the type of advice you're giving. So, and it only takes one client to raise a stink with the state that, that can get you in a lot of trouble. Yeah. So those are the things I look at. So number one, do you have assets? Number two, do you have revenue? And number three, are you in a high-risk business? If any one of those three apply to you, then you probably want to think about starting an LLC. So that's just from the get-go. That's the initial thing I would say there. In terms of S corporations, which I think was the other part of your question, yeah. I will tell people an S corporation is an incredibly powerful tax-saving tool. It is not a legal entity. And a lot of people confuse this. I think an S corporation is a corporation just like an LLC or C corporation. It is not. An LLC is a tax election. And I recommend you need to be making net profit take home between $25,000 and $50,000 before it's going to be worth it to you to form an S corporation. Because when you do an S corporation, you got to file a separate tax return. You're probably going to have to hire an accountant, maybe even a bookkeeper to make sure it gets done correctly. You got to pay yourself a salary. So there's going to be monthly payroll cost. You know, so there's a lot of costs that come into play when you're doing that. Now, it is going to save you money in the long run, but not until you're making enough money to justify it.
Sure. If someone is nodding their head now, listening and saying, yeah, I probably should create the business as an LLC or form the business as an LLC, where do they start? How do they do that?
Well, there's really a couple ways they can do it. They can do it themselves for free. All you have to pay is estate filing fees. And I'm sure there's more than enough information out there online to teach people how to do that. There are some pitfalls, though, when you're doing it. You need to make sure you use the proper registered agent. You need to have the right business address. There's things like that that you need to be concerned about. You would need an operating agreement, which you're probably not going to draft on your own. I have one for sale on my website that a lot of people purchase. So you're going to need that. That's the first way to do it. And that's probably the cheapest way because there's basically no cost to that except for the filing fees and maybe if you buy an operating agreement template. The second option, you can go to a DIY service. Again, we offer that on my website too. I'm not trying to sell our services. You can go to anywhere you want to do this. But that's the second option that we have for people to do that. That's going to start at usually between $199, $200, maybe $300 in terms of the fees. Where services that do this, that offer this type of thing will get you is on all the upsells. So they'll advertise maybe like $69, form your LLC. But then by the time you're done with all the upsells, you spent like $1,500. So you need to be careful about that.
Wait, what's an upsell to an LLC?
Oh, the registered agent, annual reporting, a bunch of stuff that you would never even know what it is. And it's probably not anything you need, but they'll try and sell you the corporate binders and tool and kits and things like that, that nobody needs that anymore, really.
So you can have behind you in your videos on your bookshelf.
Sure, if you want it, for a small fee of $79.
Yeah, exactly.
The same thing that you can go to Staples and get for free or for like 10 bucks.
Yeah.
Or you can just scan into your scanner and put it in Evernote, which is what I do. So that's the second option. And the third option, obviously, is to hire a lawyer to do it for you. And that's going to be more expensive. But depending on how complex your business is and how many LLCs you need, you know, that's something to think about.
And each state charges something different for the LLC. Like California is stupid.
Actually, California is really cheap.
What?
You should know this. The filing fee for California, I want to say, is like $100, $80, something like that. It's really cheap. Where they get you is the annual franchise fee that's $800. That's what I'm thinking of.
The $800 fee. Like, come on.
But they don't charge that up front, or nobody would form their LLCs. The first year is like $80.
right. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
So what else should people be thinking about to be protecting themselves? And what are some of the other mistakes? You mentioned earlier, by the way, like trademarking stuff or copywriting stuff. Let's first talk about like the basic difference between the two. I always get mixed up between what's a copyright versus what's a trademark.
So you just had your website redesigned, right?
I did.
And you also hired a copywriter to help you with a lot of copy too, didn't you? Yeah.
Yep.
So hopefully you have a contract with that copywriter that assigns all the intellectual property in that to you. So when I'm talking to clients about this, what I'm recommending is that they you don't need to copyright everything. Copywriting is actually a pretty inexpensive process. But if you have a book, like I would copyright a book. If you have a sales page that converts really well that you don't want people to rip off, I would copyright that sales page. You don't actually need to register anything to get the copyright protection. You've got the copyright protection as soon as you take those words and put them in a tangible form. You know, I've got my notes here from for what I was going to talk about. As soon as I wrote this down, it's copyrighted. Now, it has to be published too, but so I guess this isn't published. But as soon as you type something out and put it out for the world to see, it's copyrighted automatically by law. Where people get confused is if somebody comes and rips off your sales page, for example, that converts really well, and they post it and they're trying to sell their own, you know, Rick Mulready products under their name or your course, then at that point you say, okay, well, I want to sue them. And there's big money in that, to be perfectly honest. I know somebody used to prosecute those and they did lots of them. And at that point, you need to make sure that copyright is registered. And it costs like $40 or $50. They just changed the fees. I'm not sure what it is to register. And you can do that. The problem is it takes 9 months. And before you walk into federal court to file that lawsuit, you have to have the registration. It used to be that you could have filed the registration and be waiting on it, and then you could file a lawsuit. Now, the Supreme Court changed that, and you actually have to have your registration paperwork in hand before you walk into federal court. And so... Now, there's ways to expedite it, but it's expensive. So I typically tell my clients, if you've got something like a high converting sales page, a course that you're selling, a book, anything like that, one of your most popular podcast episodes that you want to make sure nobody rips off, or videos, that's the stuff I would copyright. So copyright protects the written artistic form. It's fairly inexpensive. That's a copyright. And I will add, like, as a YouTube creator myself, YouTube does a really good job, maybe too good, of policing this stuff. Their algorithms can detect if there's stuff that's stolen like almost immediately, which is why they've got these copyright strikes. It's not because people are going out and saying, oh, I saw somebody's posting, you know, my stuff on their other channel. It's because their algorithms catch it and they notify you immediately. So that's copyright. Now, you also asked about trademarks.
Yeah, just kind of the difference. Before we go on to that, so someone has a course. Someone has an online course that they sell, does really well. They should file what you're recommending. They should file a copyright for that course so someone else doesn't just rip it off.
Rip it off.
Yeah. And when you say rip it off, I assume you're making, you mean like they're taking the exact same thing and stealing it for themselves. Is that what you mean?
They could be doing that, or they could be transcribing all your videos and redoing all the videos themselves with themselves doing it with the exact same language. They could be copying all the copy from your pages. They could be copying all your downloads. They could be copying, I mean, all that stuff.
Interesting.
And they could be using and selling it as themselves. Or they could be trying to impersonate you and put the whole course up on their own platform and try to say that they're Rick Mulready selling the same course. That could happen too.
So, okay, that brings up another thing, because I always get these emails like from somebody like they're like, hey, this is what we do. We help you fight somebody selling your program for like $47 and you're selling a $9.97 course or something like that. And over 7 years, it's happened countless times, right? Someone just taken your course and they just put it up themselves on their own site or whatever, some aggregate site, and they sell it for super, super cheap.
Yeah.
And people ask me about that. Like, well, when they experience that, they're like, what do you think I should do? And I'm like, this is going to happen. It's not the first time it's going to happen. If this is the first time, it's not going to be the first time. It's not going to be the last time. And And I just like, you know what? Just keep moving forward. Like, pick your spots. What do you say about that?
I agree with that advice. Honestly, as a lawyer, I do agree with that advice. I guess it depends on if it's infringing on my ability to make money. Like, if I was making a certain dollar amount every month from my course, and then all of a sudden it went down, and I found out that the reason it went down is because somebody was pirating my course and selling it on another website, I'd probably want to do something about that. So I guess it really depends what the effect on you is. There's really three things you can do. The first level, number one, before you do anything, is you want to make a copy of the course. You want to make sure that they actually are stealing your course. You want them to take screenshots. You want to document it. You want to get your evidence in line. Make sure they're date stamped, all these type of things. Once you've done that, then you can send them a cease and desist letter and ask them to take it down. And if they don't respond to that, you can do what's called a DMCA takedown. And so you can actually notify the host provider that's hosting the website and they'll take it down. They don't mess around with that.
We have done that before, actually, come to think of it. We've done that a few times over the years. And the host provider is always really good about that. Like with clear evidence, like we're like, hey, here's the deal.
Right? Yeah.
So how does one copyright their course? Like, all right. We're gonna copyright a course. How do we go about doing that?
You'd have to file it with the U.S. Copyright Office.
Okay.
You'd have to send them whatever they need to show that they have all those material that you've copyrighted all these materials, and you'd have to send it in with a fee to the Copyright Office.
Gotcha.
And there's a process for doing that.
Okay. Now, what about trademarking? Now, what's the difference between the two?
Okay. So trademarking is like your brand. So the art of online business, that's the name of your podcast, right? So potentially that's something that could be trademarked. Now, where I get a lot of questions, there's a couple issues there. The first issue is how trademarkable is the name in and of itself? Is it a descriptive name? Is it an artistic name? Is it a suggestive name? Purely descriptive names or generic names? Like if you had a store that sold milk and you called it the milk store, you can't trademark that. That's a purely generic name. That's not capable of being trademarked. If you had, a descriptive name, like I've seen, and I'm trying to give an example that isn't a client that I'm working with right now, but he had a really great example of this, but I can't give it away. But basically, what a lot of people will do is like the online income earning course. We're going to teach you how to create online income. Even my course right now, the Online Business Legal Toolkit, I think is very close to being too descriptive to be trademarked, which is why I haven't trademarked it at this point.
Too descriptive? So,
too descriptive. If it's too descriptive, you need something that's suggestive. So like Greyhound bus is suggestive of being fast. So that's that you can trademark that. Apple computer is what's called arbitrary because it's a name that's completely unrelated to the product it sells. Well, you can trademark that. And then the other one I would use is Google as an example. Well, that's what's called an artistic name. It's completely made up. There was no Google before there was Google.
Right.
So that's capable of being trademarked.
Did World exist before Google?
I don't know. I don't think so, but it's not the way we know it. So yeah, those are the different. So do you have a trademarkable name? And that's the thing when people hire me to do trademarks, that's something that we deal with on a regular basis. So I'll do a search and a lot of times the search will help me understand whether or not the name is capable of being trademarked because I can find other similar names when I'm doing the trademark search and I can read through all the filings and say, okay, well, this got declined because it was too descriptive. And that's how I know, like this client I'm working with right now who wanted to use this name that I thought was an awesome name, to be perfectly honest. I thought it was suggestive. I didn't think it was descriptive. And then I went through the trademark filings and I saw a very similar name that had been declined because it was too descriptive. And so I told him he had to come up with something else.
But that's different. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that different from a similar name in a similar space, right? That's
so
a different kind of scenario.
Yeah. So let's say you have a great name that you want to, you know, let's go back to our Greyhound example. A lot of people use suggestive names because that's a good sweet spot, right? It suggests what the product is about without being too descriptive. But let's say somebody wanted to go out and start a business, transporting people by Greyhound cars, right? That I think you might have a problem with that because now, even though it's suggestive, it's also competing with Greyhound in the same class. So that is a potential for problem. And the first level of the analysis is, do you have a name that's capable of being trademarked? The second level of the analysis is, are there any competitors that are selling under the same name or a similar name? It doesn't have to be exactly the same in the same class that you're selling in. If you have a name that's capable of being trademarked and there's no competitors, then you're going to be okay. But that's why I spend, when I'm working with clients, I spend a ton of time at the outset doing that research to see whether or not we're going to have any problems.
Yeah,
because I'd rather file. I don't want to file something that gets declined.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't know. Sometimes you got to roll the dice. But you know, I'd rather. And a lot of it really depends on the attorney that gets assigned to the file. When we talked about copyrights, copyright is a system where you pay the fees. You're going to get your copyright. Like there's no arbitrariness to it. Trademark is much more of a. You know, the fees are a lot higher. It's $275 per class. It's going to $350 per class on January 1st. And it costs a lot more to hire a lawyer to do it for you. And there's no guarantee that you're going to get your trademark. And it's a use it or lose it system. So if you stop using the mark in commerce, then you lose the trademark. Versus copyright's good for, life plus like 90 years or something. I can't remember. It's a long time.
Life plus 90 years?
It's like 75, 90 years after they die. It depends on when the copyright went into effect because laws change over time. But yeah, you're protected for a while.
What about, I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit and I don't even know if actually this is like something that you teach or focus on, but what about the employment side? There's always the big question of contractor versus employee, especially here in California. Like the rules are ridiculous, especially over the past year, right?
Yes.
What are some things that people should be thinking about when they're thinking like, oh, I can, because like I have friends who they have contractors on their team and I'm like, that's an employee, right? But, you know, so like what are things that people should be thinking about when it comes to, you know, the designation of contractor versus employee?
Well, I mean, I think it really depends on things like how much control do you have over the person, right? If this is their only job and they're using a computer that you gave them and the software that you gave them, and you're telling them what to do on a daily basis, and it's a full-time job that is not scheduled to end anytime soon, then they're probably an employee, right?
Yeah.
Versus if, I'll give you a good example. So my wife she's an attorney too. She works for the Department of Justice here in North Carolina. And there's another employee that works with her who's been there for years. She's a contractor, but What that means is, number one, she gets paid hourly. In every year, she has to take like 30 days off because they can only, a contractor can only work for a certain period of time, and then they have to stop working by default. So she's on a contract with the state. So it's not the same, but it's a little different.
Yeah.
But so that's the type of thing you would look at. Now, if you're hiring somebody from overseas, then if they're a foreign worker, they can be a contractor and that's okay.
Sure.
You're not going to hire them as an employee. But yeah, those are the things I look at. Like, how much control do you have over them? Versus like, we were talking before we came on here tonight, like I'm looking to hire a video editor, and you know, that's somebody that I'm going to hire. I'm going to send them my video and I'm going to tell them to edit it, and they're going to use their tools. They're going to use their software. They're going to use their expertise, and they're going to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
That's, and I'm going to pay them on a per project basis. That's a contractor. That's the definition of a contractor.
Sure.
It's basically their own business.
And it's also good. It is going to, like, it's going to vary state by state. What is,
yeah,
how should people look that up? Like, for their state? Because everyone's different. I had a friend of mine recently, we were talking about this, and they live in Virginia. And I was like, well, the first thing you want to do is like, what are the laws in Virginia from an employment standpoint? Because they were looking to bring on their first full-time person.
I think number one, it does vary somewhat by state. Each state's going to have their own rules. However, there's going to be state issues, but there's also going to be federal issues with regard to taxes. Mm. Like, the IRS is cracking down. Like, I know a therapist here where I live in North Carolina, mm-hmm, who had everyone on her team was a contractor. And then the IRS changed the rules and said that you couldn't do that anymore. And so now they're all employees. But where you can get really dinged is, not only can you get in trouble on a state level, and I know with California, you're talking about like the Uber thing and all that stuff, right? Is that what you're
referring to? Well, yeah, but they also did the, I forget what the acronym is, or the, I don't know, something five or something. I don't know what it's called, but you know, okay, they made it more strict. You have to like qualify, you have to tick, like, you know, if you qualify, or three of the four boxes can't be checked, or something. I, yeah, know, something along those lines. They got very strict with it.
Yeah. Yeah. But my point being that you got the state issues, the number one, but then you've also got the federal issues, because if the IRS looks at your business and says, you know what, I really think that those people were employees and not contractors. Well, guess what? Now you're going to get dinged for all those employment taxes that you hadn't paid on their behalf. Right. Yeah. So yeah, that could be a substantial amount of money.
Yeah.
And I actually know somebody that happened to. He got audited and they looked at his stuff and they said, you've been paying contractors all these years and they're actually employees. So yeah, pony up the money.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. Yeah. But every state's going to be different. I mean, there's going to be some sort of Department of Employment or Commerce Department or something like that in each state that's going to have rules regarding that.
Yeah.
And I mean, California independent contractor rules, that Google that, and that's going to, sure, that's going to give you everything you need to know in all likelihood. Just make sure you don't go to some, you know, wacko blog, go to the California
go to the
government page, yeah, that has the actual rules that are updated.
What are some other things that people are not thinking about? And I know that you like to talk about this whole lock it down system,
yeah,
if you will. What is that all about? Because I think that kind of answers my question as far as the types of additional types of things, yeah, that we need to be thinking about.
Yeah. So that's something I've come up with recently. I haven't really made that public yet, but it's going to become public here in early 2021.
It's making it public now, Jim.
It's making it public now. And everyone's going to know about it now that I'm on your podcast. I know that. So there's really four components to my lock it down system that I'm going to start teaching here in the next month or so. And it starts with your legal foundation, which we already talked about, making sure you have an LLC, or if you don't need an LLC, making that decision. Some people want to form corporations. There's partnerships. There's all sorts of different choices in that regard. So that's the number one component of the system. The second component we also talked about is the online protections you need, making sure you have those privacy policies in place, making sure you have a terms of service, making sure if you're selling products, we didn't talk about this, but you have a terms of sale that you use with your customers.
I was just going to ask you about that. As soon as you said that, I was like, ding, 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 I got to ask you about that too. But keep going. We'll come back to that.
Yeah, no, we'll come back to that
as well.
You need to make sure you have the legal disclaimers that we talked about, those type of things. And there's a ton more. Mm-hmm. The third part of the system is contracts. And if you have an employee, you're going to want to have an employment contract. Mm-hmm. If you're hiring a contractor, you want to have a contractor agreement. If you're working with people one-to-one, you need a professional services agreement to deal with those type of people. So there's all sorts of different contracts that you need to have. If you're a life coach, you're probably going to have a contract that you to deal with your clients that you work with. And then the last thing we talked about extensively is the keeping your IP safe, and that's your copyrights and your trademarks. And also, we didn't talk about this, but your trade secrets. So I know you've got a pretty good business going, and you have employees and different things like that. Mm-hmm. So you probably have a lot of processes and systems in your business. Well, those are all considered what I would call trade secrets, and you need to make sure those stay protected as well. That's not something you're going to register, but there are systems to make sure, you need to put systems in place to make sure that those things stay protected.
Within the team, do you mean?
You want to make sure somebody doesn't leave your team and go work for, Pat Flynn and say, look at Rick, he had these great systems. Let's steal them.
I would go right after Pat for that. Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay.
So there you go. So you want to talk about the terms of sale and the online protections.
Yeah. So what we're talking about here, just to kind of clarify for everyone. So like on your, you see it, on an order form, for example, a lot of people have like a link there to like the terms and conditions of enrolling in your program or something like that. Talk about that. Like, because this is a real big source of contention, because oftentimes there's that checkbox. People just check the box, don't read it. Mm-hmm. And then they come back. And then, so what do we as course creators need to be thinking about when it comes to that sort of document?
So there's a lot of things that go into that document, but just off the top of my head, the things I'll tell you, you need to make sure that, let's start with this. You need to make sure that the product you're selling is covered by the contract that you've got linked to in the terms of service.
Yeah.
So I've seen lots of situations where people have multiple different products or multiple courses, and they use the same terms of service for every one. Yeah. So you need to make sure every time you produce a new course that you update your terms of service to include it in that terms of service. So you don't need to necessarily use multiple terms of service or terms of sale. Just call them terms of sale. You don't need to include multiple terms of sale documents, but you do need to upload or update the document that you're using to reflect the new courses. So I know you just offered a new course. Hopefully you updated your document. I'm sure you did.
We did. And I'm kind of laughing because I've made that mistake in the past where I was like, oops, forgot to update that. I mean, we caught it, but it's kind of obvious, right? That these terms of sale need to reflect this program. And so cool.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that's as simple as just adding the name of the course in the introduction section, right?
Sure.
You need to make sure it's got venue section. So if there's any issues or questions, you'd want to make sure that a suit would be brought in San Diego. Some people like to include arbitration provisions in there, which means if there's an issue, it would be arbitrated in, again, probably San Diego for you. You can have damage limitations in there. There's all sorts of things, but one of the ones that's probably most important that I know you're probably thinking about is the refund policy.
Yeah,
for sure. Make sure your refund policy is clear. You need to make sure people understand what they need to do to entitle themselves to a refund. I know for your programs, people need to go through the program and they need to put forth a good faith effort, and you need to define what that means in the program, and they need to submit their work if they want to get a refund. And then there's going to be limitations. Or conversely, if there is no refund, you need to make sure it's clear in your contract that there are no refunds for this course. Like for me, for my templates, I don't offer refunds for my templates.
Yeah.
So if somebody buys a template a la carte off my website and they want a refund, well, I'm sorry, you just got access to all my intellectual property. I'm not giving you a refund for that. Right. So
they took it, they copied it, and I want a refund.
Yeah. So that is a problem. So So those are some of the things that I would say need to go in those terms of sale. And there's more as well. Intellectual property issue. There's all sorts of things.
One last question for you. What about overall business insurance? From a legal perspective, to protect your, especially if you have events, live events, when we can have live events, that sort of thing. Is that something that's necessary for businesses? And if it is, what type of business should really be thinking about that sort of thing?
I would say yes. I mean, it is a different world we live in now, right? Because you're working from home you've got, but I suspect I can't even think of how you would get injured working on your business from home, but I suspect there's probably some exclusions in your homeowner's policy for commercial activity.
Yeah.
like if you hosted a big party at your house for clients and things like that, that might be excluded. I recommend, and I have, a general liability policy. It's $1 million policy that just covers my business. And I would recommend at a minimum, you get something like that. It's usually like $200 or $300. And it's going to be a policy that basically takes effect if other insurance policies do not cover you. A lot of people, if they rent space in an office building somewhere, the landlord is going to require a insurance policy like that.
Yep.
So you definitely need to make sure you have some sort of policy. Again, not very expensive. You know, some people, they do some funky things, like they'll buy a car in the name of their business and things like that, but then they'll use their personal insurance on the car. That's a no-no. Don't do that. Make sure you buy auto insurance that's commercial insurance. It's more expensive, but you get the tax deduction. You know, and I've got legal malpractice insurance. There's other things. I mean, there's a ton of different types of insurance.
I find this stuff fascinating.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
Weirdly, I find this stuff fascinating. So I have been both taking notes on our conversation here and also writing notes over on my iPad here, that things I need to be looking into myself for our business. So lastly, you have 100,000 subscribers on your YouTube.
Yeah.
So what types of topics can people expect when they come over to watch your videos?
It's a lot of, we talk a lot about everything that we talked about here today. I talk about trademarks. I talk about LLCs. I talk about S corporations. I talk about contract issues, all those type of things. I typically post a minimum of one video a week. They usually drop on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Eastern time. It has been more regular. It hasn't been since Thanksgiving, but typically on Fridays, I also drop a second video that talks about entrepreneurial type of topics as well. So that's kind of what I talk about. And, you know, I have fun with it. We're good. It's a party.
What's the name? It's a legal party over there. What's the name of the channel so people can check out your videos?
Yeah, you can go to youtube.com/HawthorneLaw. It's HAWTHORN, no E, law. And you should be able to find my channel if you just search Jim Hart or LLC, all my videos will pop up, but it's Hawthorne Law.
And guys, I'll link that everything up on the show notes for today's episode as well, all the links that we're talking about here. And then you also have a free legal audit.
I do.
What is that and how can people get it?
So that is something that I put together as an upsell for people that sign up for my webinar. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to make it available to anyone here that's in your audience that would like it. If you go to hawthornelaw.net/Rick, you can get that. It's a 2-page document, and it just walks you through. It's a checklist that walks you through all the different things that you might need to be aware of when you are setting up your business, or even if you've already got your business set up and you just want to make sure, you know, that all the things that we talked about here today are taken care of, you can just check the box and go through everything and see where you're at.
Awesome. I'm going to go to that link myself too. So hawthornelaw.net/Rick, and then Hawthorne Law on YouTube. And then they'll get information as well about your lock it down system through your videos. Also, when they sign up for the free legal audit there, they'll get information about it when you have it, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
They will. As you know, I'm starting to do some webinars, and I'm going to be doing a webinar in January talking all about the lock it down system. And so you can sign up for that on my website. There's a link right at the top, and it's hawthornelaw.net. And so, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's
Jim,
good. Now,
thank you so
now
much,
I'm,
man.
You're welcome. Now I'm going to be, like I said, tonight was the first night I announced this lock it down system. You're forcing me to go out there and we're going to be talking about it soon. No, I'm not nervous. I've already got the webinar
now,
like 80%
millions
finished.
Millions of people around the world are going to know about it. No, I wish.
No, it'll be good. No,
but a whole lot of people are going to know about it. So now you have to do it, which I love.
Oh, I'm doing it.
Okay.
It's going to be fun.
Good stuff. Jim, thank you, my man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Appreciate it. Take care.
So, do you know what your online business personality is? Well, if you haven't taken my quiz yet, you don't know the answer to that. But I want to help you figure out what that is. I want to help you figure out what makes you so darn good at what you do as the expert that you are in whatever niche that you're in. And I also want to help you find your hidden blind spots, the hidden roadblocks, the invisible roadblocks. We all have them in our business, and they're invisible, or they're blind spots, because we're so close to our business and we don't know what they are, but we all have them. And these are the things that are actually holding you back from gaining traction and momentum in growing your online course business. So I want to help you figure out what those are so that you can blow past them. Okay. So I put together a quiz for you. RickMulready.com/quiz. RickMulready.com. I realize I always say that really fast. RickMulready.com/quiz. This quiz is going to help you discover the invisible roadblocks that are preventing you from gaining that momentum and traction in your business that you need to scale forward towards 6- and 7-figure business goals. Okay. At the end of this quiz, it's going to give you personalized results based on your answers to the 11 questions. You can do this quiz in like 47 seconds, right? You're going to get from the results a focused forward action plan with 3 specific steps that you need to do right now that can help you create sustainable revenue and consistent revenue and build your ideal business. Okay. So go to rickmulready.com/quiz, take that quiz, and then shoot me a message somewhere, Instagram, in the Optimized CEO Facebook group, whatever it is, and let me know what your result was. All right, my friend, thank you as always for listening today. Super appreciate you. I'll see you right back here for the next episode, which is going to be a quick tip episode here on the show. I'll see you right back here. Until then, be well, my friend.